If it please the court, my name is Sean Gian, attorney for appellant, the Fishing Company of Alaska. This case, but for the gloss, the additional regulatory and procedural gloss that's imposed by the Magnuson-Stevens Act, is a simple case. The secretary violated the substantive and procedural requirements of the Magnuson Act, and that illegal action cost the Fishing Company of Alaska and other regulated entities millions of dollars. And to be specific, the new management measures imposed by the National Marine Fisheries Service of one usable flow scale, the single line of sight requirement alone will force FCA to tear apart its five vessels and reconstruct them to a single line construction. And the limitation on mixing of hulls imposes an ongoing 30% regulatory inefficiency, which will correspondingly increase costs for all regulated entities in this sector. Our case has two essential components. The first is the usurpation of the authority that Congress granted solely to the councils to develop and recommend conservation and management measures. In this case, the secretary admits to having created the supplementary monitoring enforcement measures that are at issue. The only question is the legality of the secretary's actions in this regard. The second aspect relates to the substantive compliance of these measures with the national standards for fisheries conservation and management under the Magnuson Act. Fishing Company of Alaska contends that these lack a rational record basis to support a finding of consistency with these standards. By statute, the record created by the council when the decisions are made are the focal point of this court's review and the record upon which the secretary's determination must be made. Essentially, in typical administrative law context, this is the end of the decision-making process, and the secretary was in error to try and backfill and create a post hoc record to justify the decisions that it alone had made. These failures, of course, are interrelated because the council did not recommend the measures. It did not develop the record, forcing the secretary.
Let me ask you a question or two about that point, okay, about your procedural argument. Do you agree that the formal submission came in May 26, 04? You agree that was when these were formally submitted to the agency, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor, although it was May 2005, 2 years after the council's final action.
May 26, 04, right?
05.
05? Sorry, you're right. Okay, the regulations that the secretary ultimately approved a year later were virtually identical to those, weren't they?
Yes, Your Honor, and
okay,
this is where the...
So your theory that the council has the fundamental, you call it legislative authority here, and that the secretary simply approves it really isn't tested by this case, is it? Because the fact is that the secretary ended up approving what the council formally submitted.
No, Your Honor, because the council was not even aware of these measures
That's a different question. That's your other argument, right? That this was submitted by the executive director. Right? I mean, let me ask you this: if the council had formally submitted this by itself on May, on this date, then you agree that there would be no question about what the secretary did, because the secretary issued as a regulation what the council had approved, correct? Had submitted.
Let me see if I understand your question, and let me explain.
What I'm trying to understand is your argument really boils down to your argument that it was the executive director, not the council, that submitted these, correct?
No, Your Honor. It's a statutory based. 16 U.S.C.
You're relying on the statute for that proposition.
I do, right? But the council never, the proposed regulations must implement the recommendations that the council made. That process ended in June 2003.
Let me try again, just once more. If on May 26, 2005, these had been submitted not by the executive director, but by the council itself, then you wouldn't have any complaint at all, correct?
I would still have a complaint if the regulations didn't implement the measures that the council had previously chosen in the amendment, because by definition they must do that.
But they did, right?
No, they didn't. They were additional. They were additional management.
Didn't the May 05 submission include the additional M&Es?
They do, but...
Okay, if the council had submitted those in May 05 and the secretary issued them, where's the procedural problem?
The procedural problem would lie in the fact that the secretary's duty upon receipt is to evaluate the proposed regulations for consistency with the amendment. Those proposed regulations would not be consistent in that they enact additional measures that the council
never enacted. I don't understand why they're additional. The council submitted all these M&Es in May 05, didn't it?
The executive director.
The executive director affected
an improvement in the submission. I'm trying to find out whether there's any argument. I understand your argument about the executive director.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to understand whether there is another argument here. You seem to suggest in your brief that there's an additional argument that even if the council had submitted these in May 05, there would be a procedural problem, correct?
I do. I do, Your Honor.
Okay, but why? That's what I don't understand. If the council had formally submitted these after a vote on May 26, 05, that included all the three additional M&Es, didn't it?
It did.
That's what the secretary published as a final regulation. So where's the problem?
That's true as well.
So where's the problem?
The problem lies in the procedural requirements of the Magnuson Act. Conservation and management measures must be developed through an open public process. Judge Chauvel in Oceana 2, Oceana v. Evans, the reported decision, made essentially the same finding that when the council uses the wrong process to implement certain measures, the fact that regulations are properly submitted.
If I understand correctly, your position is the council didn't use any process, right? Because the council didn't see these.
Indeed, they were never analyzed. They were never chosen and selected.
So that goes back to the action of the executive director in May 05, right?
It does, but it would be an end run around the procedural and the public comment aspects of the law to allow the council itself to simply take final action on a set of components that are supported by hundreds of pages of analysis and then do regulations which ostensibly implement those components and yet add new substantive measures through that. That's why we say even if the council had done that.
Let's hypothesize that the executive director actually considered the merits of these things, but then let's extend that to the council. Let's suppose that instead of the executive director acting, the council had acted, and prior to its acting, it had followed its bylaws and handbook about the ordinary process that's supposed to precede council action on proposed regulations, right? Mm-hmm. If the council had done that, this procedural argument disappears, right?
In that case, had the measures been recommended, yes, that would disappear.
The complaint is simply, you're in a way saying we have no idea what the council would have done because the council didn't do anything. There's a good deal of merit to that claim. But what we see is what the executive director did, and to say that the council, besides not sending the proposed regulations at all, didn't do the predicate things to sending the proposed regulations. Well, of course it didn't.
I can accept that characterization,
okay.
And it's not necessary to decide the case. Indeed, the agency worked on these regulations, which we contend should be essentially a ministerial act of reducing the components voted on by the council to regulatory and implementing language, and then...
That's all the agency does?
Yeah.
Well, why does it have to put them out for notice and comment?
Well, because then the public has the opportunity to comment as to how
But if they have a ministerial job to just publish them, what's the purpose of the notice and comment? And why is the council then commenting just like any other member of the public?
Well, Your Honor, I believe, violates the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Congress especially comprised these councils of people with special knowledge and gave them the authority, essentially relegating the secretary to the role of a reviewing court.
Okay. Let me ask you, let's focus on...
So that is the area in which he is explicitly authorized to make changes, namely if he finds that the regulations are not lawful.
No, Your Honor. He must remand them back to the council.
I'm sorry, yes. Okay.
He finds the
unlawfulness and then sends them back. You're right.
Yes, sir.
So let's just focus on your executive director argument for a minute. Are you alleging that the executive director violated the rules of the council by submitting these on May 26?
No, that's not part of our case, Your Honor.
Huh?
Well,
that he violated standard operating procedures or rules and bylaws.
If the council the council can issue its own rules and regulations, right? They can create a executive director and delegate duties to the executive director, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, well, is there any indication that the executive director here violated those rules by submitting them?
I don't know what those rules would be. I do know
the bylaws of the council
my whole point.
And its
How?
Handbook are on the web, and they're there for all to see.
Yeah, right? But you're not arguing that they violated those rules, right? You didn't argue that in your brief at all.
No, and okay. I don't think our claim.
So then I don't understand the problem. I can understand your argument if the executive director had violated the rules of the council, but you're not arguing that. So I don't understand how you could take the position that this was an unauthorized submission to the secretary.
Appellant's contention in this case is that new measures cannot be created solely through the artifice of proposed regulations implementing a fisheries management plan. It is also further our case that
I've lost you completely.
I truly don't understand your argument.
The proposed regulations under the statute come from the council and go to the secretary to be put out for notice and comment, right?
That's correct.
So what was this last sentence you just uttered?
That new management measures may not be created solely through proposed regulations if they are not in the amendment itself.
So now you're back to the argument that I thought maybe I was just dreaming, but I thought you had conceded you weren't making. So your argument then is that the fundamental defect here is that the secretary developed these three new amenities and sent them to the council, right? And
yes.
So that even if the council itself had formally returned them to the secretary, there would still be a procedural violation of the statute, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, what?
Well,
where is it in the statute that that's
It's inherent in the definition of proposed regulations. Proposed regulations are regulations the council deems necessary and appropriate for the purposes of implementing.
Well, is there something in the statute
amendment
that prohibits the secretary from giving the council some suggested M&Es and the council decides that they're appropriate and returning it to the secretary for his approval? Is there anything that prohibits that?
No, Your Honor. The secretary holds a seat on the council.
Well,
the secretary engaged in a colloquy over the period of 2 years between final action and never raised the issue of monitoring enforcement inadequacies. And I submit the council made a very reasoned determination, going so far as to say our measures are enough and asking their technical advisors to approve that.
So let's be sure, we completely understand the arguments you're making now. You're making two arguments. Number one, that it was a violation of the statute for the council, assuming the council was acting on May 26, to resubmit these M&Es to the secretary because they didn't originate in the council, correct?
That is correct.
That's number one. And your second argument is that the statute was violated when the executive director, in addition to that argument, right? When the executive director submitted them, correct? As opposed to the council, right? Or no, you're not making that?
The import of that is the council never deemed these additional measures necessary as the act required.
Oh, I see. So you're making the claim.
So that is your claim. Now
yes,
I understand.
I'm
you're
sorry,
not making a separate.
You seem to withdraw it.
Right. So you're not making a separate argument about the executive director being unauthorized. Your point is, now I understand your point. Your point is that whoever submitted them on May 26, 02, 05, thank you, whoever submitted them on those dates, that was a violation of the statute because these three M&Es didn't originate in the council. That's your argument, right?
I am sorry for being so unclear, but that is our
okay.
argument,
thank
Your
Honor. Thank you.
Can I just ask you a question about the government's brief here? On page 31, I'm sorry. I thought it was, maybe I have two copies. Yeah, I do have two copies. No, I'm sorry, that's a different brief. The government's brief on page 31, it says the proposed regulations submitted by the council included all the M&E provisions contained in the final regulation. And then the same formula is used five lines down on that page. Are you saying you have no quarrel at all with that characterization of what happened?
That it's undisputed on this record.
The regulations submitted by the council. In other words, you accept the characterization that the council submitted the proposed regulation.
Our contention, clearly the executive director submitted that. Clearly the executive director was authorized to submit regulations that were consistent with the action the council took. It
what
is I, not our contention that the council.
What action did the council take?
They developed a 600-page amendment with 10 components with subcomponents analyzed in hundreds of pages of documentation and as far as those proposed regulations implement those choices, the executive director was authorized to submit them and the council therefore did submit those. It did not submit the additional NIMS M&E requirements that it never deemed to be necessary nor implement any aspect of Amendment 79.
If the action of the executive director is the action of the council, then the proposed regulations submitted in May 05 contained these provisions, I really am lost to figure out what your complaint is.
Two things. One, the executive director is an agent, clearly, of the council. He's authorized to, he may perform his acts to the extent authorized. But let me make an analogy. The clerk of the Senate could not take a bill that had passed both the Senate and the House in identical form, add a new provision, and pass that on to the secretary,
yes.
To the president
he
for
would
signature.
Lack authority
actually,
to
actually,
do that.
We recently ruled that could happen.
Is this that good law still? Yeah.
Okay. We actually have. But go ahead.
But that's the analogy. I mean,
I'm sorry. So, contrary to your former answer to Judge Tatel, you are making a contention that the executive director was not authorized by the council to submit to the secretary the proposed regulations in the form that they had in May 05? Yes, I mean, yes or no? I'm just trying to figure out what your contention is. You've completely lost me.
I do apologize. Was he authorized to create new measures by his own submission? No, he's not.
So then you are questioning his authority to act in the absence, on this issue, in the absence of explicit council direction. No?
I am. And what we're challenged is the legal effect
exactly
of things.
When I asked you whether or not you were arguing that the executive director acted without authority, that he had no authority under the rules of the council to do this, you said, no, you weren't making that argument. I asked you twice, and you said, no, of course you're not making that argument. Your argument, you assured me, was that the problem is that these M&Es didn't evolve from council deliberations. So, I mean,
indeed, I don't know what bylaws or the operating procedures he operates under. But what's common to both those arguments is that if he effectuates this pro forma submission, there's no legal effect as to those components.
Your point is that even if on May 26, 05, the letter to the secretary had come from the council, was signed by all members of the council, it would still have violated the act because those three M&Es did not evolve from council deliberations, correct? That's your argument.
It would depend on how that, you're saying that the council acted as a body corporate
the council,
to send a letter
exact
saying
we
approve
same thing
these
happens
things.
On the 24th, the secretary sends this to the council, right? It says, please resubmit them. The council meets, sends them back. Is there a violation of the statute?
Well, certainly that would be a deeming that didn't exist in this case. They would have deemed those necessary and appropriate. The question would be, do they implement Amendment 79? I would argue that that is a procedural violation. And as goes to the second set, there's still no record to support these. There's no analysis, no determination.
Let's go on this procedural issue or issues.
Okay.
Are you making two claims or one claim? There's the claim, which I take it as your primary claim, that it's a procedural defect that these provisions were developed by the secretary. Is the argument with respect to the relationship between the council and the executive director entirely dependent on that proposition, or is it a freestanding argument?
Our argument is not that the secretary participated in the rulemaking or the rule drafting process, regulation drafting process. Our argument is that these regulations do more than implement Amendment 79. They create these three new
that's
management
a substantive,
measures.
That's a substantive argument. At least sounds substantive to me.
Well, but there was no deeming by the council. So to the extent that we're talking about the deeming is more procedural and the implementing is more substantive, yes, there was
so
no deeming by the council.
You are making the argument that quite apart from the origins of these provisions with the secretary, there was a complete lack of action by the council because the action, that even if they hadn't been developed the way they were, the action that was taken was by the executive director rather than by the council. Is that right?
Yes, that goes to the failure of the council to deem these necessary and appropriate.
And where
in the record is there any indication that the executive director, whose duties are determined by the council, didn't have the delegated authority to submit these to the secretary?
What's in the record, Your Honor?
You don't, because you can see it's not there because you don't argue that, right?
That there was an explicit authorization?
You don't argue that he was without authority to do it.
I believe we did, Your Honor.
You did? Well, do you put the regulation, are the rules of the council in the record? I mean, show me in the record where the rules are and which provision of the rule you rely on.
Your Honor,
for the proposition that the executive director acted ultra vires on May 26, 2005.
Our argument in that regard, Your Honor, is that the council on the record was not made aware of these measures until after the executive director had formally submitted. The meeting was in May or June 4th or 5th, about a week and a half after formal submission.
Can we go back? Suppose, A, that the council had authorized the executive director to assume this decision-making role, and B, that the council could lawfully do that, there would be no problem on this score, right? Is that correct?
With respect to the deeming these,
okay.
Yes.
And question Judge Tatel is trying to extract is there any place at which you challenge either the question whether the council made this delegation or whether it had the authority to make the delegation?
I believe in our briefs we conceded that to the extent the regulations submitted by the secretary correspond, that is, implement its recommendations, the executive director is authorized to submit it. Our argument with respect to the failure of the council to delegate to the executive director any specific authority to create new measures by his submission is supported by the fact that, well, there is an absence on the record of them saying you may do this, but also they were unaware that there were new measures in these proposed regulations until after submission had occurred. So there was no way they could have a priori authorized them to approve those three measures when they weren't even aware they existed.
Let me ask you about the transcript of the June 3rd, 2005 meeting of the council. Can you get out your joint appendix? It's J.A. It's J.A. 00745.
I do.
Okay. At the top, this Sue Salveson begins by saying, as I reported earlier, Amendment 79 was submitted for secretarial review last week on May 26. For purposes of council members who may not have been around, when the council adopted this action, this was in June 2003. Now, that's Amendment 77, right?
79.
Okay. Further down in the paragraph, she says, we have an amendment and a proposed rule. Describes the amendment as being very brief, and then she goes into this proposed rule that would be authorized under Amendment 79, gets into very specific regulatory infrastructure. She goes on at some length, and I get the impression from these council members who I guess may not have been around, as she puts it, don't know what she's even talking about, because on the next page, at 7:46, one of them says, just a procedural question, is this our opportunity to comment on Amendment 79 proposed rule? Is this going to be our only opportunity?
That was the former chair of the of the council who made this, who did the summation and quoted.
Am I correct that this is the first time, is this your argument?
Oh, it is the first time.
It's the first time council sees whether or not the secretary can propose regulations or whether only the council can this is the first time that council sees these proposed regulations?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the district judge brought out the point that he didn't see the regulations because the executive director hadn't brought them
right.
to the meeting.
Indeed,
right.
But it also supports the fact that they were not circulated prior to submission in May.
I do, but I'm not sure they do any good. Yeah.
What are they asking? Do you want to hear him on the substance?
Yeah, let him start.
All right, could you address
yeah.
the substance?
Yeah. Right.
Yes, Your Honor. In Oceana v. Evans, 384 F sub 2nd, 203, Judge Huval invalidated a set of conservation and management measures because the council and secretary.
I'm sorry, Judge who?
Judge Huval at the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia.
In this
That's
case?
Not this case.
No, I'm sorry. I'm
citing
referring to a
case.
Different case.
You're citing a different
Oceana
case?
Versus Evans.
I see. Uh-huh.
Because the secretary used the wrong procedural vehicle to implement these measures, a framework as opposed to an amendment in that case.
And I thought you were going to address the substantive issue.
This bleeds over, Your Honor.
I see.
She stated, to allow the secretary to evade the procedural and substantive requirements of the act would be to grant a carte blanche to the agency to do an end run around the public comment procedures laid out in the Magnuson-Stevens Act. I raised this.
But there were public
raised
comments.
This issue because.
There were public comments, weren't there?
There were APA.
The secretary
public
put
comments.
This out for public notice and comment, right? And there were comments, and you commented. Your client commented.
Indeed. And the Coast Guard did as well.
Yeah.
However,
I thought we were going to get to the substance. You have a substantive claim, which, as I understand it, is that the secretary, in effect, was arbitrary and capricious because the provisions you're contesting do not meet the practicability standard.
That's right. Then there is a lack of a rational record basis for these determinations.
Okay.
But that failure stems from the fact that the failure of these to be developed through the Magnuson-Stevens Act's public processes, which are substantive requirements, that the secretary's own implementing guidelines suggest that the purpose of these analyses is to inform the decision-making process. Unlike the typical APA case, that process comes to a conclusion when the council makes its recommendation. Thereafter, there's only review for compliance with the law and a possible remand. But the record is developed for compliance with these national standards by the council through a public process in which the Coast Guard participates, the agency participates, the regulated industry, and interested persons like interveners can all participate to develop and iterate. So it's not sufficient that FCA and the Coast Guard had an opportunity to comment on a proposed rule. What was missing was this substantive.
So you're now back to your argument that these did not evolve from the council itself. That's your point, right?
I am, and I would like to make the
okay.
you know the substantive point that
right.
Congress delegated to the council the decision as to what level of precision and accuracy it would like to see in its monitoring enforcement requirements as a matter of policy.
Okay. Does your argument do all of your? Let me ask you this: do all of your arguments, your APA type arguments, your arguments that the secretary failed to adequately take account of cost, for example, for some of these entities, are those all dependent then on your argument that these entities did not evolve from the council process? Do you see my point?
The lack of a record basis evolves from that fact, uh-huh. Your Honor.
So if we were to disagree with you about that point, your procedural point. In other words, if we were to conclude that there was no procedural failure under the statute, when on May 26, 2005, the M&Es, the regulations and the amendment were submitted to the Secretary. Then does that end this case?
No, Your Honor, because the failure for the Secretary to articulate a rational record basis for the findings that these three measures were compliant with National Standards 7 through 10.
Okay, well, the Secretary, I mean, if you read the regulations and the record, the Secretary did consider each of these M&Es. I mean, in the record, there's discussion of each one of them. And the Secretary concluded with respect to each of them that, you know, yes, they would be costly, but the benefits outweighed the cost.
And
what more is the Secretary to do?
Well, for one, the record that the Secretary should be reviewing would be the one made before the Council.
Let's not go beyond that, because I really need to understand your argument. That's why I keep asking you whether or not your APA argument is dependent on your argument that the fundamental flaw here is that it wasn't the Council that developed the M&Es. See, now I'm beginning to really understand your argument. Your point is that if the Council had developed these three M&Es, there would be a fully developed record, right? There would have been testimony on it, exactly, right?
And yes, Your Honor.
They would have come to the Secretary with that fully developed record, right?
Yes.
And then what would the Secretary do at that point?
Make a determination as to whether those measures were compliant with the national standard.
So your point is that the record here isn't adequately developed for that because these three M&Es did not come out of the Council's deliberative process, right? That's your argument.
That is my argument.
Okay. Let's assume we don't agree with you about that. I mean, you may be right, you may be wrong, but just for purposes of argument, let's assume you're wrong about that, okay? Now, assuming that, what remains in your argument? Where, in other words, if the May 26th submission did not violate the statute, then we have the following notice and comment, right? And the issuance of the final regulation. Now, where in that is there a legal failure on the Secretary's part?
At that stage, we're left with the agency's, the Secretary's, unsupported allegations, for example, of necessity of these rules. You'd have to look hard to find any scientific justification to support that bare assertion. I think this is shown most clearly in respect to the justifications to the safety concerns that the Coast Guard, the Fishing Company of Alaska, and Legacy Fishing Company raised in their comments. Because there you have a record which merely shows that agency staff was concerned that they needed to build a record for litigation.
Well, didn't the Coast Guard ultimately consulted the Coast Guard, right?
They did. They asked them a specific narrow question.
And didn't the Coast Guard, in some cryptical words, ultimately say okay?
No, Your Honor. They answered the specific question.
Wasn't the question one of safety?
No, the question was, are these measures that we, the agency, are proposing adequate to reduce the amount of time that Fisher spent on deck? And that is the question the Coast Guard answered.
It does
relate to that, Your Honor.
Right, and didn't the Coast Guard change its mind?
Right.
It first thought it would increase the instability, and then it said no.
No. I mean, I think everybody agrees the longer you have 50 tons of fish on deck, the more time you're, you know, subject to.
By the way, what do you think about the intervener? What do you think about the intervener's brief and their point that, hey, look, this is basically a conservation statute, and conservation trumps these other considerations?
The practicability bounded requirement to minimize bycatch is not the conservation purpose of the Act. The conservation purpose of the is enshrined in National Standard 1, to prevent overfishing and obtain sustainable yield. The First Circuit's decision in Conservation Law Foundation v. Evans could not have been decided that way. If this, being a subsidiary objective of the Act, which is designed essentially to meet the major conservation purpose, which is to create healthy and sustainable fisheries.
Tell us more about, another of your objections here is that they didn't sufficiently consider the cost, right? The agency did not sufficiently consider the cost of these new measures. Is that right?
They never even attempted to.
Well, they have cost figures in here. They say it. They say it could cost. It could cost. Over $300,000. I mean, this cost figure is in here.
Again, but they. Those figures were all associated with the costs that were associated with the council's recommended measures of the additional observer and installation of flow scales. Not there was no attempt to monetize the no mixing requirement or to seek equivalent level of data as to what it would take to convert vessels to a single line configuration. The council, when they wanted, the council, when it wanted to know how much it would cost to install flow scales, went to a shipyard. FCA, when it wanted to know what it would cost to comply with this rule, did the same thing. In terms of best scientific information, those are of equal dignity. But the agency never sought to garner that information. They merely asserted that they had subsumed all these costs in their earlier analyses.
But can't you? I mean, the secretary. It says over $300,000, so it realizes these are going to be expensive. The secretary has understood that the cost of implementing these are going to be expensive. It even acknowledges that some ships may have to leave the area, right? And it decided that even given that, this was necessary to promote the conservation goals of the statute. Isn't that what the secretary is supposed to do?
My understanding, though, is that in that context, they're talking about the overall groundfish retention standard regulation, of which the substantive component of this rule, as opposed mm-hmm. to the monitoring enforcement, is what would cause people to go out of business. But yes, they do consider some costs, but the question becomes, what's our bang for the buck? That's the concern of National Standard 7, to minimize costs. We don't know, as compared to the council's M&E requirements, what additional increment of precision and accuracy we're getting. We don't know whether it's worth the millions of dollars in costs that those additional measures impose, because there was no attempt, even qualitative. I mean, understand, the agency has to undertake cost-benefit analysis. It just needn't be quantitative.
Can we go back to our friend, the executive director?
Yes.
As I now think I understand your argument, it is that assuming that the executive director was authorized to assume all the council's powers on this matter, and assuming that the council could grant him or her those powers, there still was a violation, because the executive director, exercising all those powers, failed to go through the procedures necessary to evaluate, procedures that without such a delegation the council would have done, necessary to evaluate these measures. Is that right?
I'm not sure what those procedures would have been, but I can say that perhaps the better course of action, whether required or not, would have been to hold back those regulations and present them to the council a week and a half later, to have them review and pass upon. That in which case the council would have
I guess
the opportunity
again,
to
again
do.
I'm afraid you've confused me. You appeared to be arguing that the council had not done a review of, for example, the costs and benefits involved in these measures, right?
Yes.
And you believe that such a review is required, right?
Yes.
Because of the language of practicality in the standards, right?
Because the, yes, the...
Okay, so my question is, assuming the executive director has all the powers of the council, it still would be, in your view, a procedural violation because the executive director did not go through, as far as we know, any equivalent procedure reviewing these additional provisions. Right?
Yes, I believe so, if I understand your question right, that that analytical process didn't happen, and the executive director, assuming he had all the powers of council, didn't rectify that failure. Yes,
that is true. Okay, and basically you point to the absence in the record, I take it, of any specific evaluation of these measures from a practicability point of view. Is that correct?
That is our contention, Your Honor.
Okay.
The only attempt, and I will say, the only attempt to do so were in the preamble and question and answer of the final rule and the final regulatory flexibility analysis, where these issues were discussed, but the contentions that they had been part of the analyses that were submitted by the council, I mean, our contention, that's not enough. That is the sort of, backfilling hidden record that, the Portland Cement case said was inadequate. It is not a council-based pre-decisional record on which to find that a rational decision was made.
All right, thank you.
And thank you very much.
May it please the court. Stacy Person representing the federal appellee, and with me at council's table today is Lauren Smoker of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. As we've heard, this case involves two distinct sets of issues. One set involves whether the National Marine Fisheries Service, or NMFS, followed proper procedures in promulgating the Ground Fish Retention Standard Regulation, or GRS regulation.
Can we just explore that momentarily? You aren't contending, are you, that as long as the Secretary of Service did exactly what was required of him or her, there's no problem, right? You aren't, or are you, denying that antecedent failures are irrelevant?
No, Your Honor. We're not saying that the court's only allowed to look at what happens beginning
at the secretary.
Okay.
So yet, the secretary has a duty to see that things come to him in the right way.
That's correct. But in this case, Your Honor, there was no hint to the secretary. There was nothing in the record that the submission had come to the secretary incorrectly. What happened here was that the...
Do you think it did come incorrectly?
No, Your Honor.
Oh, that's what I thought.
No, we submit the procedure here from the council process throughout the secretary process was correct. And in any event, there was no suggestion at any time during the process that it was incorrect.
So you're making a waiver argument?
A waiver in this?
A waiver of the procedural defaults at the council level.
Our position is first that there were no procedural defaults.
I understand that.
And
then you have a supplementary argument that there was a waiver?
Yes, that this it was never brought to the council's attention, nor was it brought
to the council's attention.
No.
No, I thought your argument was that even if there had been a procedural default, at the June meeting, the council was fully briefed on this, and it never objected to the new eminence, right? No member objected.
And when you say the June meeting, that's the June 2005 meeting,
right?
After the, following the submission,
mm-hmm.
Yes, the council was briefed on
right.
the proposed rule, as well as Amendment 79,
right.
And the council had an opportunity to deliberate on the proposed rule at that time.
Right.
The council
the rule was not in front of them, right?
No, but the agency did present the details of the proposed regulation, and the council had an opportunity to deliberate at that time.
Can we put aside the I characterize this as a ratification argument.
Right.
Could we go back earlier? Let's assume that we have before us, it's unclear, a contention that in fact the executive director was not authorized to do what he did. Okay?
Okay.
We'll just assume that, arguendo. Do you know if the bylaws and handbook of the council have been modified with respect to the role of the executive director and the fundamental decision-making power of the council or duties of the council between May 05 and June 07. The website has the handbook and bylaws for June 07, and we're not clear what antedated those.
Your Honor, I am not aware that there have been any changes, but I don't know that for certain. I would have to find that out and get back to you.
So no one representing the secretary has made any inquiry into the bylaws and handbook in terms of their provisions with respect to delegation to the executive
no,
director.
Your Honor, and that's because it has not been an issue as to whether the executive director had authority to complete the submission on behalf of the council. So it was not raised as an issue that the secretary needed to look into.
Well, I noticed that you, in your brief, this passage at page 31 that I read to the other council, uses the word council when it actually means executive director. I guess I inferred from your substitution of counsel for executive director that you wanted to convince us that we should regard the executive director as the equivalent of the council.
And in this case, I think that's appropriate, Your Honor, because the council effectively ratified the submission.
Let's put aside ratification. Can we do that? Just put aside ratification, please. Let's
okay.
take things up to the activities of May 05, through the activities of May 05, right?
Yes.
And so your argument is that until today, you had no idea that there was a problem about the executive director acting in lieu of the council.
No, Your Honor. If you could restate the question, Your Honor, I'm not sure.
Well, until today, you had no idea that there was a question whether the executive director could assume all the powers of the council with respect to, could assume or be delegated all the powers of the council with respect to the vetting and forwarding to the secretary of proposed regulations.
No, Your Honor, that's not really correct. We do address this in our brief, but it was more of an anticipatory argument. I don't believe FCA has not made the argument that the executive director did not have authority to affect the submission, but we do state in our brief that the executive director can be assigned duties by the council, and that the submission was executed on behalf of the council by the executive director.
In that passage of the brief, you point to nothing indicating that the executive director was authorized.
No, we don't cite rules or bylaws.
Do you know of any case where, well, let me step back. It's the case, isn't it, that at least one of the council's major responsibilities is its vetting and forwarding to the secretary of proposed regulations. They seem to be listed first in any number of enumerations of council responsibilities. So would it not be fair to say they're really a major, at least a major responsibility of the council?
Yes, Your Honor. It's important for the council to submit proposed regulations.
Okay. It's an important part of the council's duties.
Yes.
Right. And I just wonder, do you know of any case where a decision-making body, particularly a decision-making body that involves hearing argument and making decisions about what amounts to legislative regulation, can just give all that power to a staff member?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor.
No.
But I do think it's significant here to look beyond the date of the submission
I'm happy to do that. But before we do that, let's take the other issue that came up in prior counsel's argument. And that is, let's suppose that the executive director is lawfully authorized to stand in every respect for the council. Did the procedures required by the act of somebody, is there any indication in the record that they were followed here?
Was there an indication in the record that procedures were followed when the executive director?
The council is supposed to hear people, right?
Yes.
On these matters. And it's supposed to reach decisions and confront issues, right?
Yes.
The practicability issue, right?
That's correct.
It's supposed to do all those things. Okay. And we're assuming, arguendo, that the executive director now can do all those things, right?
Right.
What's the indication that the executive director did them?
Your Honor, I think that question presupposes that there were substantive additional requirements added to the regulation.
Are you saying that these new requirements are just technical provisions that the secretary could have added anyway?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that these provisions were required, they're integral to the agency's ability to enforce the statute. And so in that way...
I'm sorry, but how does that take them away from council decision-making or the decision-making by the council surrogate?
When the council approved the motion in June 2003...
Oh, 2003, okay.
Right, in 2003, yeah. that laid out the framework for what the GRS regulation would look like. That was not the council's action at that time. It was not frozen. The council anticipated that there would be extra things needed in order to carry out their intent. In fact, they specifically talked about the M&E measures and said there may need to be another look taken at this M&E component. And And that's exactly what happened. The agency looked at the M&E component and found that to effectively enforce the statute, these items would be...
The secretary did all this.
Right, in drafting the regulations.
But is there, but the statute appears to require that the proposed regulations come from the council, which we're now assuming is the executive director, right?
Right. But it's our position, Your Honor, that because the council anticipated that more might be required, and in fact it was required, that what the agency did here was really just to carry out the council's intent. This was implementing the policy that the council wanted.
Well, and that would be true without regard to how costly these measures were,
and how
modest their contribution to the purposes of the statute?
No, Your Honor, because the council anticipated that these measures would be very costly, and they recognized at many times throughout the process that this regulation was going to have significant economic impacts on the regulated vessels.
And maybe you are. Are you denying that the incremental effect of these provisions, as opposed to what was forwarded in May of 2003, is trivial? Because I hadn't understood anything in the record to support that.
No, the effect of these measures is not trivial, because the effect is that it enables the agency to prosecute.
Well, I was thinking about the effect on the other side, the side to which FCA objects.
Oh, the economic impacts of these.
Right, practicability.
No, it's not trivial. And the council and the agency recognize that it's not a trivial.
Did it recognize that in relation to any examination of these particular measures?
Yes, Your Honor, it did.
Particular measures?
Yes.
For the
ban on mixing of hulls, for example, in the joint appendix on page 684, it states that...
Yeah, what's it?
That was page 684?
No. Who's doing it?
This is the agency. I believe this is in the final environmental analysis.
This isn't the council, right?
No, Your Honor. It's in the final environmental analysis that was issued along with the final regulation.
So this is all something happening after the council has acted.
Analysis is happening after the council.
Okay.
Had
so
acted.
So so assuming the council had some duty to examine these questions, that doesn't address the matter at all.
Well, the council in the June 2005 meeting following the submission, the council was aware that these particular measures would be costly. They were informed of these
individual
measures.
That's your ratification argument.
Yes, right. That's the ratification argument.
Let's stick with the council's obligation that Judge Williams is questioning you about. I mean, I now think I finally understand the appellant's argument here. I think I do. I think their argument is, and I'm just to pursue what Judge Williams was saying, is that even if the council had been the actor on May 26, even if it had been in a formal letter from the council, that it still would have violated the statute because the council hadn't gone through the process of having its own consultations and hearings about these three additional measures. That's their argument.
Yes.
So, what's your answer to that argument? What's your answer to that argument?
My answer is that the agency did not usurp the council's process here, right. And we can see that in part, and I'm going to go to the June 2005 meeting, but not in the ratification sense, but because the council there was made aware of these particular provisions. They were made aware of the costliness of these provisions.
Now, this is without the provisions being in front of them.
Yes, Your Honor, but they had...
What was the role on the agenda of the of this issue?
The title on the agenda?
Or yeah, the, yeah. I mean, was it?
It was
a, an action item.
It was a discussion of Amendment 79 and the proposed regulations, and then later in the meeting there was an action item. I think it was entitled "Staff Tasks" or something along those lines, where the council actually there was a motion put forth, and the council actually voted on that motion as to what recommendations to make to the agency regarding the proposed rule. And unfortunately, the minutes of that June 2005 meeting did not make it into the joint appendix, but I can certainly provide those to the court, which shows the agenda items and the later motion.
We do have cases saying that after the fact, sort of review of things that have been already decided doesn't really count. In other words, if you decide first, off with his head, and then you have the trial, that is not considered normally good enough, even in administrative law.
Yes, Your Honor, but here it wasn't after the fact in the sense that the council was able to make recommendations to the agency. It was still a collaborative process at that point, that they were able to submit something to the agency, and the agency took those recommendations into...
Of course they can, right? I mean, they have free speech.
Yes, but the agency gives those recommendations great weight, as we can see by the fact that the only thing that the council suggested the agency should do is to delay the effective date, specifically for the reason that this regulation would be costly and could involve, quote-unquote, a major retrofit of the affected vessels.
All right, so now I think I get it. Your position really boils down to the proposition that the council did everything it was supposed to do. It just did it after the submission of the proposed regulations to the secretary.
No, Your Honor, the council did everything it was supposed to do and everything that it was required to do. And what's more...
Let me see if I understand your point, okay? Your point here is that what the secretary sent to the council on May 24 were additional measures the secretary thought were necessary for enforcing the provision, right?
Yes.
And that the council returned those to the secretary for public hearing, notice, and comment, right?
Yes.
And that, so that when we are judging the legality of the secretary's ultimate regulation here, right?
Yes.
We're looking at the record created as part of the notice and comment proceedings following the formal submission to the secretary.
Yes, Your Honor, that's
and
correct.
And it's that record that either supports or fails to support the three additional M&Es.
Correct. And it's that record that supports...
Okay, and what's your answer to the appellant's argument that the flaw here is that those M&Es were simply returned by the council to the secretary without first going through the deliberative fact-finding process that the council does?
Our primary argument is that the council, the executive director's submission on behalf of the council is fine because these M&E measures are consistent with what the council wanted. And the statute doesn't, as Judge Robertson pointed out, the statute does not require any particular deliberative process by the council before the submission is affected.
No, I understand.
And
so it really is an argument that under the statute, it's proper to have action first, deliberation later.
It's an argument that the statute does not require deliberation first.
Before.
So
well, but the statute, it depends on who the actor is here, I think. I mean, I thought the government's point was that this isn't deliberation afterwards, because this is public notice and comment procedures on the additional M&Es, right? And the council was authorized under the statute to comment on those, correct? Which it did.
Yes, the council is authorized to, yes.
Right.
But just to go back a moment, the statute requires deeming by the council, right?
Right.
Right, and the deeming phase, at least under a conventional reading of the statute, would precede the submission, because in fact, I mean, the language is that proposed regulations deemed by the council to be necessary and appropriate are to be submitted. I mean, I think there's almost no possible reading of that that doesn't make the deeming precede the submission.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the executive
couldn't the deeming have occurred when the council made the decision to submit them on May 26?
Yes.
That's when the deeming occurred, right?
Yes.
And this, your point is the statute doesn't require any particular procedures for the council to go through to make its deeming decision, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
I see that I'm well over my time. I'd be happy to answer any other
questions. Let me just ask you one question about practicability. Assume arguendo that some form of a loose form, let's say, of cost-benefit analysis is required. Is it your contention that it is proper to look at the total package and say, humph, as a total package, the benefits exceed the costs? And that,
yes, Your Honor, to the extent that is reasonable.
And that would be true even if there were a major component of the package for which the costs exceeded the benefits 50-1. Is that correct?
It would depend on what's reasonable in the situation. The agency interprets the statute as requiring a reasonableness standard.
Right.
And in most instances, it's probably appropriate to look at the whole package and to assess.
If you can go back to my hypothetical.
Okay.
We have a major new element, which is severable, right?
Right.
Okay. It's your contention that it's perfectly fine for the council to say that no problem here, because even though the cost-benefit ratio on this is 50-1 costs to benefits, the overall program has a favorable ratio. I mean, accept my hypothesis. You may deny it right after, but accept it for purposes of this question. Assuming it is a major severable component.
If it were a component that was integral to the rest of the program operating as envisioned, yes, they could say it's okay that this component costs so much.
What does integral mean? Part of my question was that it was severable, and
if it were
the fact that it wasn't in the original proposal suggests that it was severable.
If it were severable, Your Honor, it may be that the agency would not find that provision consistent the agency can look at individual provisions. Our position is not that we can never look at an individual provision.
Well, my question is not so much can, but must. Mustn't there be a look at a major severable component?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that there
you
should
think
be.
There must be a look at each major severable component.
Where it's raised, particularly, if I can give you an example of how that worked in the context of this regulation, with National Standard 10, the safety of human life at sea, what happened was the agency looked at the GRS regulation as a package, and they said, this is consistent with National Standard 10. But then the Coast Guard raised an issue and said, wait a minute, this ban on the mixing of hulls might cause a safety concern. So the agency at that point went back, looked specifically at the ban on mixing of hulls, looked at whether it could deal with the safety issues, and found that there were a number of ways, in fact, that vessels could approach that ban in a safe manner, and found that it was consistent with National Standard 10. If it hadn't found those alternative safe ways of handling the ban, perhaps it would not have found that provision to be consistent with National Standard 10.
Okay, but then to the extent that there is no separate vetting, apart from that, your argument is essentially one of waiver. It wasn't raised. Is that right?
That the
question of the practicability of these measures was not properly raised.
During the process?
Well, of course, during the process.
During the notice and comment period, for example?
Well, I was thinking more at any stage.
I'm not sure exactly how to answer that, Your Honor. Our position is that what the agency did here was they looked at the costs and benefits of each individual provision.
This is the service.
NIMFS looked at the costs and benefits of each of the provisions. They looked at the costs and benefits of the line of sight, for example. And so they assessed those impacts. And at the end of the day, looking at the cumulative total of the impacts of each of the provisions, they came to a conclusion about the regulation as a whole.
Mixed apples and oranges. Cumulative total impact of each of the regulations. Are you speaking of cumulative impact, or are you talking about each of the regulations?
I'm talking about the impact of the whole package.
Okay.
But in order to get to that point, they looked at each of the provisions. Thank you. With that, we ask that the court affirm the district court's judgment.
We'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honors. One quick point with respect to the National Standard 10 analyses. I said that the Coast Guard did address the narrow question asked, but the fixes that the agency came up with have no record basis and, in fact, were designed to meet the one concern about keeping fish on deck. They said make holds bigger, add additional holds, tow it behind the vessel. But those solutions have no basis in the record. One's illegal. One doesn't help the economic component, which is not the ability to be able to deploy your net and pull it back. And the other implicates safety concerns. It was a last-minute scramble to backfill and make post hoc justifications of the record. I would also point out that in August of 2003, the Council did take that second look at its M&E provisions, and they determined that enough was enough. Another reason there was no authorization to go beyond what they had already decided, because they took a second look at it that they promised they would.
August 03,
that's correct, technical committee meeting. And finally, with the issue of
what is the significance of that?
the significance of it?
Did they then?
That the council had made a policy choice in June of 2003 as to what measures were enough.
But if enough was enough, then why didn't it submit the regulations then? It waited until 05 when the secretary returned them with three new M&Es.
I have no idea why it took 2 years to draft a page and a half of regulations.
No, that's not my point. My point is if I thought your point was is that the council had concluded in 03, is that what you said? That enough was enough? Now, why didn't it at that point then go ahead and formally submit Amendment 79 with the regulations to the secretary?
I think simply, Your Honor, because they hadn't been drafted. Could they have? Yes, they could have, but the process continued. And in the interim, they said, well, let's take a look at whether enough these monitoring enforcement requirements are enough, and at their next meeting held a technical committee meeting to evaluate the sufficiency.
Great.
With that, we ask you to reverse the decision below.
Thank you.